This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Hello, everybody. It's terrific to see you. Thank you for coming along today to the National Museum of Australia for the third in our Spirited Australia's Horse Story lecture series. It's a great pleasure for us today to welcome Professor Paul McGreevy from the Faculty of Veterinary Science at the University of Sydney to the museum to speak with you. Paul was involved in the exhibition's development as a scientific advisor, and many of you will know his work. He's a member and co-founder of the International Society for Equitation Science, and his research interests include equitation science, learning theory as applies to animal training and behaviour modification. It's a real privilege to have Paul speak to us today about how horses think and learn. The format of today will be Paul will give his presentation, and then we've got some questions that have been submitted by email, and we'll talk through those, and then there'll be an opportunity for a general discussion. So if you have questions, we'll look forward to getting those from you towards the end of the session today. I did just want to note that because Paul's a vet, he can't give advice on specific clinical or behavioural cases today, as he's not himself been able to see the animals. So if we can keep the questions in a more general vein, that would be fantastic. It's a great pleasure to welcome Paul and to invite him to tell us about what he's learnt about how horses think and learn. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Martha, and thanks, everybody, for making me welcome. Feels I'm among friends. I'm sure that you're all as pony mad as I am. And if you see something that you'd like to question me on during the presentation, that's fine too. It's not a formal lecture, and you won't be examined at the end. So. I'd like to thank the museum for all the opportunities it's given me over the last 12 months. Also the faculty, because the Faculty of Veterinary Sciences is very supportive of my work, even though it at times is quite contentious work that I'm presenting. These are my research colleagues. These are my beautiful horses. That's the front office. And they teach me all the time. So I'm not supposing for a moment that I remotely know everything. I'm just fascinated in the journey that horses are taking me along with. The way they communicate with each other is a study in itself, and just when you see a photograph like this, you realise that there's communication going on all the time. They're communicating with each other where in terms of the space they're going to occupy, who they're next to, who they want to avoid being next to, and all of this can happen at the gallop and in terrain that they don't actually necessarily know. So that's a reminder that they are learning and they're functioning in a completely different way to humans. They see the world through different eyes and they feel the world differently through their skin and through their feet. A lot of what we do is to do with taking a humility pill and accepting that we actually can't climb inside their brains and know what they are thinking or experiencing or suffering. But if we spend enough time with them, I think we can learn some valuable lessons. So I've been lucky enough to spend a total of three sabbatical periods, 6 months each, just studying horses in paddocks and in the feral state, so watching Brumbies, and that's where I really get a lot of my research ideas from. Just another gratuitous horse photo, really. A lot of these are Friesian crosses, most of them have been born on the property, so I've seen them develop, and it's been a fascinating journey. There are some really interesting familial relationships that I can observe. My partner Rob took this photograph. It really speaks volumes about the dynamics of the social interactions between horses. These are two mares with their foals, and they're just meeting a younger sister, and she's on full observational duty to remain safe, and these foals have arranged themselves to remain safe as well. And it reminds me about the importance of safety to horses. Horses are looking for safety signals all the time, and clearly it is more valuable to horses than food on occasions. So the way we use safety in our training is, I think, going to just become more and more clear and more important. Yes, they use food, and I've got a really nice question that's been sent in about the use of food in training. I'm really interested in how it can be used and the limitations of using food in training. I mentioned that horses are social and they're tactile. This is a lovely illustration of the areas on the horse's body that are regularly or rarely allo-groomed. Allo-grooming is grooming another. Auto-grooming is grooming yourself. Allo-grooming is grooming another. And this is a bonding behaviour, especially after horses have been through some sort of traumatic event. Say, for instance, they've been through a sale yard, they will often find a horse to bond with. And the fascinating thing is that they lower their heart rates when they're doing this. So they're in a very safe place. And a horse with a lower heart rate is largely a happy horse, because it's not being preyed upon, it's not in a dangerous situation. And we know that we can actually hijack that by scratching the horse in those hot spots. So that red area is an area that we can very easily reach from the saddle, and we can scratch horses and caress them there, and that's a way of rewarding horses. We can also groom them in places where other horses can't. I mean, just between the front legs is a place that many of you will recognise is a really itchy spot for horses, especially young horses. Foals will just go off into seventh heaven when you groom them in that area. So we can actually do things for horses that other horses can't do. And my use of grooming is how I first get on horses when I'm doing foundation training. I realise I should be wearing a helmet and not a stupid grin. But the point is that these horses are just having a lie down in the paddock. Then the bipedal, the monkey comes up and starts giving them some really important scratches. And if they stay put, the scratching carries on. So they get paid for being quiet and still, and that allows me to be the monkey on their back eventually. And it's all mediated through touch and scratching. So they're not being given food rewards. There's absolutely no fear. They're actually being paid to stay still. And that's the first time they have seen a monkey on their back. And they are just, the moment they look as though they're going to move, the scratching stops. If they stay still, they just get scratched. And they seem to thrive on that. We know that the whole area of horse behaviour is a booming area for researchers. When I wrote this book in 2004, I was amazed that I could find 1,000 peer-reviewed references for horse behaviour, and they went into that book. There was a chapter in that book called Equitation Science about the training of horses, and that's something that has developed over the last 12 years, largely thanks to my greatly valued colleague and friend, Dr. Andrew McLean. Andrew and I appreciate the different styles of horse training and the wonderful ways in which horses can be trained in different disciplines. But we've both had this scientific background, so we are required to understand the mechanisms that underpin horse training. And it's actually round pen training that forced us to demystify what's going on in a round pen. And none of this should ever devalue the love that we have for horses or that horses may even have for us. So please don't think that because I'm a scientist, I'm here to take all the fun away. I'm still in awe of what we can do for horses and what horses do for us. But understanding the mechanisms is really important because it takes away the confusion. Confused coaches and confused riders create confused horses. Confused horses are not having a good time. Confused horses are dangerous. And that's what motivates me, knowing that we can begin to clarify some of the mythologies that are doing horses no favours. and equitation science has really taken off. There's a series of annual conferences started in Melbourne. We're actually now up to the last conference was in Denmark. They're all over the place. And if you're interested, the next one is in Canada, and we've got a Canadian colleague here to fly the Canadian flag. So the next conference will be in Canada, as I say, in Vancouver. But the last conference that I came from in Denmark was absolutely exceptional. There was just brilliant science being rolled out. And what we've got now is an ability to encourage young scientists to indulge their passion for horses and go on discoveries using the horse as a vehicle. So it's a really exciting journey, and you're welcome to join the society. That you don't have to be a scientist. There are opportunities for lay people to join the society. I should be wearing a hat again. I keep forgetting. Sorry. The purpose of equitation science is to basically explain what happens when horses learn, and that also explains what happens when horses learn to behave in ways we don't want, and that includes some of the dangerous conflict behaviours that we know about. So we've got developed technology now that can pick up tension in the rein and can pick up pressure under the saddle and under the rider's leg. So that's the holy trinity of contact when you're riding a horse. That's how you use feel to communicate to the horse. And so we've now got technology that can actually explain and reveal what's going on when a good rider gets a nice tune out of a horse. And one day I predict that we'll be able to have coaches working with riders internationally through the web and saying, well, you need to let less tension in the right rein and more pressure through the left stirrup. That would be a dream, because we can then access some amazing coaches using this technology. We also use things called accelerometers on the horse's legs to work out stride characteristics. And that can tell us stride length, stride gait, stride frequency. And most amazingly, we can now use the same accelerometry technology to work out who's pulling who. Because we know that a lot of tug-of-war can happen and develop in the ridden horse. And we've developed a system now to help us work out who is actually initiating that tug-of-war, which is really important. The other thing we use is ethology. That's the study of natural horse behaviour. So we're using technology, we're using ethology, and we're using psychology. Over 100 years of psychology studies have informed how we train animals. Now, of course, the focus was on the rat in all of those psychology studies. And there's a lot we can take from those studies that tell us how other animals learn. But as you might have noticed, you can't ride a rat. So the horse is actually the best model for understanding how pressure can be used in training an animal. So this journey is now being carried forward with the horse. Why are vets becoming interested in this? Well, we know that the behaviour of a horse is going to affect its value, and the value of a horse is going to affect how much veterinary costs can be rolled out to look after the horse. So vets are becoming more interested in this, but they also recognise that the sustainability of horse use depends on doing it ethically. And now we've got this conversation going about what ethical equitation looks like and what ethical racing might look like. So the whole area of ethical horse use is being underpinned by this sort of scientific framework. We know that we can begin to study the horse-human bond. We can understand how being near a horse can raise your heart rate or lower your heart rate, how your heart rate can affect a horse's heart rate when you're riding it. So this is something that we're becoming especially interested in, and it keys in with what we're finding in dog-human bond studies. We also know that horses that are not fearful are better, safer patients. Horses kill more Australians than any other animal. If we can forget sharks and killer bees, horses are unfortunately killing more people in developed countries than any other animal. And so the calmer we can make them, the safer they are to be around. And of course, a horse that needs treatment, the more calm you can make it, the safer it is for the veterinary personnel around it. So it's extremely important for vets to understand this. And there's this awful word wastage, which describes how we discard animals that are no longer useful to us. The figures that you see bandied around about wastage in different sports are horrific, because it tells us that we're getting it wrong a lot of the time. We are training badly a lot of the time. And we're also breeding animals that will be never destined to perform. So we need to use science to ensure that wastage is brought down year by year. And all of this keys into welfare, because when people don't value their horse, they don't actually want to spend much time with it. They don't want to spend much money on it. And that's when we get horses just turned out into paddocks and forgotten. And so all of this science should ensure that we see fewer horses discarded in this way. What I wanted to just remind you about is that science is an antidote to unsubstantiated belief systems. But science can also reveal the good stuff about belief systems. It can also show you why what your grandfather did with horses works. And it can also challenge some mythologies and make sure that the horses are getting the benefit of an evidence-based approach. The reason I think that's a good idea is because if we think about human medicine, can anybody tell me what's happened to this person? Trepanning, yes. It was for centuries, it was a way of treating mental illness by letting the evil spirits out of the skull. And you can see this poor person had several therapies. They went very quiet after this treatment, unsurprisingly. And so in the short term, people thought, oh, it's working. But you can see how centuries of human care were based on belief systems that just don't stack up. So we need to have the bravery to challenge what we have always done. I'm going to talk a little bit about dressage, because dressage comes from the French dresser, to train an animal. And that doesn't mean that I've got an obsession with dressage. I think it's actually the best horse sport to study if you want to look at horse learning, because it's basically supposed to be about training. But if you think that I'm coming across as being a dressage basher, please don't think that. I think it can be the most elegant form of horse use if it's done well. But I'm going to show you some ways in which it could have deviated off the path in some ways. We know that when we change animals' behavior, we're making some responses more probable and some unlikely. And we can use either aversive stimuli, including pressure, or attractive stimuli, including social contact, food, and scratches, and so forth. If you're using those attractive stimuli, you're in this quadrant called positive reinforcement. If you're trying to get rid of a behavior using aversive stimuli, you're using punishment. That could be quite mild. You could be using very mildly aversive stimuli. You don't have to be bashing the horse around the head with a piece of 3B2. If you're taking an aversive stimulus away to make a behavior more probable and more likely, then you're using negative reinforcement. That means you're removing something, this aversive stimulus, to tell the horse it's done the right thing. And those of you who ride regularly or who have ridden will know the importance of negative reinforcement in horse training. So much of it is about pressure release. And that's the technical term in learning theory is negative reinforcement, because we're subtracting that aversive stimulus. We can even use negative punishment where we remove something that's attractive. And I'll give you an example. If you've got a horse with after you've ridden him and he's got an itchy head, his sweaty head, he might want to rub his head on your shoulder or on your body. You can actually keep him still by scratching him. The moment he moves, you stop scratching. And you've got a horse that very quickly says, I'll keep my head still. I know that. And what you're using is negative punishment. You're taking away that head movement and you're making that less likely. His head is less likely to move, because every time it does, you punish him slightly with the removal of that reward, that scratching. Now, these terms, like punishment, the prospect of people punishing their horse with the removal of a scratch seems awful, doesn't it? But those are the technical terms that have come from psychology. That's why we stick with them. But you need to know that, because some people believe that negative reinforcement sounds awful. It's just an arithmetic term. It's removing something. We know the importance of learning theory. It underpins all animal training. I've had the opportunity to understand animal training through sabbatical periods away from the university, and it's clear to me that the mechanisms are all the same. The species differ, and what they value differ, but the mechanisms are all the same. The pressure principle is also used in cattle, camel training, with that nose peg, the bull ring, the nose ring in a bull, any pressure applying device. So these head collars on these cattle, Bill and Ben they are, by the way, they're short horns. This is a Doberman. Poor old Dobermans attracted this sort of costume jewellery, didn't they? Very thin choke chains. It's the same principle. You've got to hope that whoever's applying pressure with that device knows the importance of pressure release. And the same goes for when you put a sharp or twisted bit in a horse's mouth. Any fine surface is going to apply harsher pressures. So you want to know that whoever's applying them knows how to use the most minimal and subtle pressures, and is certainly going to remove the pressure when the horses have behaved appropriately. Because putting more weaponry into a horse's mouth is not the answer. Generally, horses that have developed habituation to pressure, they're damned as having hard mouths. What people don't realise is that was man-made, and that just putting harsher bits in is not the answer. They need to be better ridden. These two guys are reminding us that even animals can train each other using negative reinforcement. This is called a hound couple, and when the older hound responds to the huntsman, the younger hound will get pressure, and when the younger hound follows the older hound, then the pressure is removed, so that's negative reinforcement. Gentle leaders and head collars in dogs and horses are using the same principle of negative reinforcement. You apply pressure until you get the response, then you take it away. Elephant training involves an ankus or elephant hook, and that's the same principle. You apply pressure until you get the response you want. That's a modern ankus and an older antique ankus, but the one may look worse than the other, but what matters is how they are used. Negative reinforcement is based on the release of the pressure as an instantaneous reward, and this is a colleague, one of the council members at the International Society for Equitation Science. He jumps horses without a bit. He's determined to strip any sort of suggestion of magic away. It looks incredibly impressive, but he can boil it down to the use of learning theory. And he starts the horse off with a bit, and then he transfers the pressure to a rope around the neck. So negative reinforcement underpins all equitation, and it can be very subtle, but it relies on the immediate release of pressure. And it's also going on in a round pen, as I've mentioned. If the horse is not doing what you want, you can put pressure on it. The moment it turns and looks at you, you can take the pressure away. And I'm not talking about physical pressure. I'm talking about the postural pressure that you can put on a horse that is related to pushing it around the pen. So it's going on all the time. What you need to be aware of is that if you dwell too much on this aversive stimulus section, if that's all you ever use and you are not good at it, then you'll use more of it. You'll have to, because the horse will habituate. If you end up using lots and lots of aversive pressure, the horse will start to shut down. And that's called learned helplessness. And it's a miserable state to be in. You can also think of it as learned hopelessness. Awful. We are beginning to understand the roles of attachment, arousal, and affective states or mood. So what I'm giving you is a framework that we're building through the International Society for Equitation Science and through some of my PhD students. We're understanding the role of all these different parties. The The notion that horses can be trainable or untrainable is a really interesting one. We know that early handling is really important, but that can be overdone. Some people advocate putting the horse on its side in the first 24 hours of life and holding it down while it struggles. The same people might argue that the horse has to be have its ears poked, its nostrils poked, its mouth poked, and even its anus poked 50 times, not 49, not 51, 50 times to create this state of calmness. The science doesn't support that. In fact, the science says that if you spend time with the mare and groom the mare and feed the mare, the foal learns more about humans that way than anything to do with wrestling the horse to the ground. So science is beginning to do horses a big favour, I'd suggest. Mares don't like to see their foals being pinned to the ground, and foals are very fragile. They can be damaged in the process. So what we're trying to do is move the bell-shaped curve so that more animals are trainable. That's our goal. We know that different breeds have different tendencies to react and also different breed tendencies to habituate. It won't surprise you to know that those amazing racehorses that you see at Thoroughbred Park are reactive. They're reactive stimuli. You don't want a dopey, slow, quick-to-habituate racehorse. So we've bred horses to be reactive. All of the racing breeds are reactive. Generally, the draft horses, the Shires, the Clydesdales, and the Standardbreds, because they're towing a piece of metalwork, you don't want a reactive animal. You want a horse that is going to be quick to calm down. You imagine in the days of our forefathers, a runaway cart horse was an extremely dangerous missile. And so we have probably put a lot of pressure on breeders of draft animals to make sure their product is calm. I just wanted to show you some of the effects of breeding, because it can affect, I believe it can affect the brain. And this is something that my colleague from Canada has been working with me, Dr. Katrina Merkies from Guelph, has been looking at this possibility with me recently. We know that the horse's vision is affected by the way its head is held. So a horse in this situation is not able to see anywhere near as much as that horse. We know that they see the world in a different way. This is a human eye view of King's Park in Perth. This is a horse eye view. You see that photographer was standing beside the horse? They've got wraparound vision and quite good visual acuity, so they can see good detail in their visual field. But it's 320-degree vision wrapping around their head. We can't really imagine what that's like. This is the distribution of cells in the retina once it's been flattened out in a dead horse. And you can count the number of ganglion cells that are sorting houses for the rods and cones that pick up light and transmit it to the brain. And what we find is that in dogs, the distribution of these cells changes with skull shape. So that the pug has got vision very similar to human, but greyhounds have got vision rather like a wolf. See, the distribution of cells is like a streak across the retina, whereas the pug has this area centralis, just like us. So they see the world more like humans, and these greyhounds and the long-skulled dogs, and they see the world more like the wolf. But of course, horses have different skull shapes. This is a cheat, because that's a foal and that's an adult. That's an Arabian, and that is a lovely standard bred. So they've got different skull shapes, and what we've discovered is that horses have different retinas dependent on the skull shape. So that might begin to explain why they behave differently. If they've got different skull shapes, they're seeing the world differently, so they're likely to respond to those stimuli differently. So we know that horses were bred for different jobs, and so were dogs. So this is the influence of breed selection for human jobs. Now, the Arabian breed standard in the States says that the horse should have a prominent eye, large nostrils, and a small teacup muzzle. Unfortunately, some breeders have interpreted that as that the horse's muzzle must be able to get into a teacup. These aren't photoshopped. And And, you know, clearly some people are very pleased with their work. It's not a giraffe. So we know that that's going to affect the dentition of the horse, but we don't know yet exactly how it's changing the brain, and that's part of the journey that we're on with Katrina. It's a horse, not a seahorse. The reason that I think that we need to study the brain more is because that can affect the way the horse works. There's a thing called laterality that you might have heard of as handedness. Left and right handedness in humans was thought to be a distinguishing feature of humans, but it's actually being found in every species of animal that's been studied. And I've been fortunate enough to study it in horses, looking at the way they smell, well, poo, actually. That's the standard stimulus. We froze a whole lot of stallion poo and then offered it to 186 horses, working out which nostril they were using to smell. And they seem to use their right nostril more than their left. That tells us that they're right brain dominant, that the majority of these animals were right brain dominant. Horses tend to examine scary stimuli with their left eye, and that may be why we have the equipment. We tend to approach from the left, and we tend to have the straps on the left. It may have been that early horse trainers spotted this. When we think about the way the horse moves, we've got the trot and the canter are a symmetrical and an asymmetrical gait, respectively. So looking at the way horses move is a really important lesson. If you're going to spend a lot of money on a dressage horse that must be balanced in both directions, then I strongly suggest you spend time watching it graze, because what we've determined is that horses can have a preference for one leg forward over the other, and there's a method I can give you to study this in your own horses. The most balanced horses use the left and right legs equally, but others, there are about 50% of horses that don't have that balance. So they tend to graze with one leg forward. They start that as foals, and they lock it in. Lock it in, Eddie. And so we see that 50% don't show a significant preference, but 40% are grazing with the left leg forward, and 10% are significantly favouring the right leg. And that's also breed dependent. So you see most of it in thoroughbreds and less of it in quarter horses. I think that's because of the leg length. We studied it with pedometers, just putting pedometers onto horses' legs and letting them graze. We found the same thing. And the follow-up to this study was a Dutch group that looked at foals and how they acquired that preference. They found that short-headed foals with long legs were more likely to develop this bias. So when we breed horses for sport work, we need to be very careful that we just don't obsess with getting long legs and short heads, because we are therefore breeding animals that are unbalanced because they graze with one leg forward rather than the other. And it even affects hoof shape. So the way they graze, you can see there's a club foot here. The Dutch study showed that the hoof shape was affected because the horses were putting more weight through the foot that was not advanced. They're putting more weight through the foot beneath them. And you find some remarkable things when you look closely enough. This is just hopping to horse sports more generally. This is a Baroque breed. This is a Lusitano. Short legs, would you agree? Yeah. So the old Baroque horses that were used for dressage always tended to have short legs and quite big banana-shaped heads. So maybe the ancient horse breeders knew that this is what you get if you breed for squatter animal. But let's just have a quick look at the results of a slow-motion video analysis. It showed that none of the horses at the Barcelona Olympics achieved the correct amount of flexion for it to be a technically correct passage. So you can see these descriptions of what a movement in dressage is supposed to be, but only when you use the right technology do you strip away the I was going to say bullshit, but I won't say that. Only when you use the right technology do you actually see what's going on. And we know that we're breeding horses for dressage and show jumping more like this beauty and less like this. So, but at what cost? Because we could be breeding in asymmetry, a lack of symmetry. And the sport of dressage has changed enormously in this time period, from 1984 to 2008. This is Rainer Klimke winning a gold medal. This is Edward Gall on Totolas. And there's a world of difference in the way these horses are trotting, because this horse Can you see the foreleg? That catches the judge's eye, but it will land after the diagonally opposite hind leg. Technically, that means it is not a trot anymore, as a trot should be a two-time beat. And certainly, the leg positions that some of these horses were extreme. This is a gorgeous horse, Matinee, who died sadly at only 9 years of age. But to ride her, you had to get your legs in quite interesting places. That meant his crotch is in an interesting place as well, because he's putting his weight through his wedding tackle. But this search for these extravagant gaits, it means that the foals are being born with different gaits as well. You can see that foal is being advertised as a top foal because it's got that advanced foreleg. When we do this in German Shepherd dogs, we end up with hip dysplasia. So I think we need to be very careful about where this is taking us. I think that the more we understand, it all went horribly wrong. The more we understand about the nature of the horse, the better we'll be able to suit horses for riders. We'll actually be able to match them, because riders are asymmetrical. 90% of us are asymmetrical. So we know that science can begin to get a better match. And I think that is part of what ethical equitation will be, because instead of forcing the horse to meet our needs, we might be able to meet it halfway. I question whether certain humans should actually be allowed to ride horses if they have such a poor match. Here's a question for you. Are some novice riders a danger to horses or to a potential threat to their welfare? Should sentient animals be the balancing device on which novice riders learn to sit straight? Is it better to use technology to solve that problem instead of hoping that the horse's mouth is not being used as a balancing aid? I think science will begin to unpick all of this. And in the process, we will become safer as riders. And that will help us move to this more trainable horse future that I dream of. That's some ideas of what we do in science, in equitation science. And I've only really talked about the horse. I could come back and talk about the rider one day. I'd love to do that, because the asymmetries and the personalities that we bring to the saddle are really important. Okay, folks, I'll leave it there and we'll take some questions. Yes.
Righty, everyone. How's that going? Is Ken up there? Yeah, we're all good. So this is the part of the show where Paul will take some questions from the floor. We've got three questions from audience members. So I'll throw to you. I don't actually have your names on my piece of paper. I'll just start with the person who asked the question about modern dog trainers and positive reinforcement. Someone here? Just down the front there. G'day, can you? So Susan will bring you a microphone.
Thanks. I try to remember.
And if you can introduce yourself, that would be terrific.
Hi, my name's Rachel Eggins. I just bought a horse. So my question was that modern dog trainers typically use positive reinforcement in their training. What are the differences between using positive reinforcement with dog training and horse training? What should horse trainers be mindful of?
Right, that's a great question. Can you hear me okay? Yeah, it's a great question, because the horse and dog have evolved in different ways. The horse has evolved to value safety. It also, of course, does value food. We know that when we rattle the bucket, the horse will come. But dogs are opportunists. They're looking for opportunities all the time. So they are closer to the rat in that sense. And so they are. There's more flexibility in their behaviour and how we can capture it with positive reinforcement. I use food rewards when I'm riding. If I want to get my horse to approach something scary, if I get a step towards that, I will whistle and then give a food reward. To receive the food reward, the horse has to stop. So what I have also created is a horse that will slam on the brakes when I whistle, which can be quite helpful. But if you're riding at speed past a whistling person, it's not so helpful. And the thing to remember is that horses, when they find something tasty to eat in the paddock, they stay still. They don't keep looking around for more. So they've evolved to actually slow down and stop. So the most elegant use of food rewards in horses, in the ridden horse, are for calming, not for increasing activity. The There is an old Aussie inventor who's developed a trick delivery device, so he can put molasses up a line through the main into a hollow bit, which is something we helped develop, but it does slow the legs down. So it will be coming on the market in the next year or so, but we need to be aware of its limitations. So they've evolved in different ways, and so that you'll get different results. But you should also remember that positive reinforcement in both horses and dogs can involve scratching. So that's another tool in your toolkit, and you will become aware of how helpful it is when you start to use it and actually use it to say thank you. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you. That's great. The second question we had was about horses' short and long-term memory. There's someone here who asked that question. Anyone there? There we go. Susan will just get you a microphone.
You don't have to if you don't want to. If we can, we can read it out.
Send it in by email.
Okay.
Would you like me to just read it out?
Yes.
No worries. Okay. So the question was, do horses have a short-term and a long-term memory, or just memory that they commit certain learnt behaviours to? Tom Roberts trained horses with a this-will-profit-you-not technique. Andrew McLean uses instant release of pressure. Do you agree with these techniques, or has your research found another technique? And the second part is, I handle my foals from birth. Some foals are only handled when necessary until broken in. Is there a difference in their learning or training ability?
It's a great question. They do have long-term memory and short-term memory. In fact, their long-term memory is equivalent to elephants. So we think of elephants as being these incredibly long-term memory animals, but horses are up there with them. And that's why we should always dissociate fear from our training. We don't want them to ever associate us with fear. The reason I say that is if you ever get your foot caught in the stirrup and come off, you want the horse to stop, not just keep running. It's just so chilling, isn't it, to think that we have maybe actually instilled fear in horses that is ending up killing people. And we sometimes, unfortunately, dress that up as a lack of respect on the horse's part. I never use that approach because I don't need a horse to respect me. I want the horse to be trained. Let's just keep it really simple. So, yes, long-term memory, yes, short-term memory. And I think when I've spent time studying Andrew McLean's methods and Tom Roberts, I think they're basically the same. The exquisite timing that both of those practitioners show is the magic. And Tom Roberts, yes, he showed you the importance of... He said, if you sit on a pin, what do? You get up. Why do you get up? Because the pin hurt, or because it stopped hurting when you got up? It's because it stopped hurting when you got up. It's the exquisite timing of that pin, because it was so consistent, that allowed you to learn the right response. So Andrew and Tom Roberts, I think, have led Australia in understanding the importance of timing. And that's going to affect the short-term memory. And they've also been careful to avoid fear responses, and that's going to affect the long-term memory. But as far as your foals are concerned, if every interaction is a good one, then you're putting money into the bank for when you eventually start foundation training, or what we used to call breaking in. And you have to accept that if you're going to vaccinate them or restrain them for picking up their feet or putting a microchip in them, that's a bit of money that goes out of the bank. So I think of putting investments into the bank. If every time I go past a foal, I can put some money in the bank, then it allows me to have less of a struggle when I have to put a microchip in or do some sort of veterinary procedure. That's the way I see it. So yes, you can certainly keep hands off, but see them as a bank in which you can invest your time.
Terrific. Thank you for that question. The third question is around whether horse racing is an unnatural activity for horses. And does anyone? Yep. Do you want to ask the question? I'll just read it out. Okay. Sweet. So the question is horse racing an unnatural activity for horses, even race horses that are specifically bred? The recent Melbourne Cup controversy caused by the tragic deaths of two race horses resulted in calls to ban all forms of horse racing on the grounds of cruelty. And so we've framed Inquirer has framed the question around getting a veterinary and behavioural science point of view of that kinds of question.
It's a great question and it's very topical. I'm sure everybody felt quite sad about what happened at the Melbourne Cup, and it seems to have galvanised people's thinking. Some people will always say that animals should not be used, and that's an animal rights perspective. If you say that animals can be used, but their welfare should be optimised, if we're going to use them, then we've got to ensure that we're doing it ethically and humanely, then you're taking an animal welfare approach. And a lot of people don't understand the difference between animal rights and animal welfare. And this is true also of racing journalists. They are branding anybody who criticises any aspect of racing as being an animal rights activist. And that's not the case. And I, for my part, I would like to see racing continue. But I think there's a different way of doing things. If we think about the use of the whip, for instance, we have to accept that tired horses are being whipped. And whipping tired horses in the name of sport is very difficult to justify ethically. It's very tricky. Especially since in Norway they've had whip-free racing for 30 years. In India they have feature races that are whip-free. And people bet on those races and horses win in every race. So you can, if the purpose of the exercise is to find the fastest horse, then you actually can do it ethically. And the racing industry, I think, is appreciating the importance of innovating. Every sport has to innovate. Every sport is innovating, and we need to help I think we need to help the racing industry understand that there's an interest in their sport and there's an ethical future. And that's, I think, I suspect that the pressure will eventually come from sponsors of races, because sponsors have to report to their shareholders. And if shareholders start saying, well, I want my money invested in ethical sponsorship, then a debate or discussion will emerge about what ethical racing looks like. We haven't got time to discuss all the facets of what ethical racing looks like, but I think science is going to actually help the industry.
Terrific. Are you happy with that? Yep. So we do have an opportunity now to take questions from the floor. Can I just check with someone who's got a watch, perhaps, Paul? How much time have we got?
We've got 6 minutes.
6 minutes, yeah. Rightio. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, just raise your hand, Susan. We'll start with the gentleman in the yellow shirt.
My name's Dick Rowe. Thank you, Dr. McGreevy, for a wonderful presentation. I wonder if you could comment on the Jeffrey method. As a veterinary student 50 years ago, I had an interest in the Jeffrey method, but of course the science of equitation wasn't about then. What has equitation told us about the Jeffrey method?
Great question. Again, it's negative reinforcement. You're taking the pressure off when you see the animal responding appropriately. And Andrew McLean started his equitation science journey with the Jeffrey method. And there's still people using the Jeffrey method. And what they show is this again, the amazing timing. Because if you hold on to ropes too long, you set the horse into a panic and create a flight response. Knowing when to take the pressure off is the key. And that's the same for all animal trainees, knowing when to deliver the rewards. Because if the horse pulls away and it gets release of the pressure that way, if it actually tears the rope through your hand, it has learned a very important lesson. So they're learning all the time, even when we're not going out to train them. And the Jeffrey method it still stacks up. And it's great that you were taught that at vet school. Unfortunately, our students are not taught that, because we just teach with the quietest horses. When you can imagine, naive novice students, often from overseas, we can't really afford the risk of giving them a tricky horse. So we've got these wonderful standard breds that are extremely tolerant, and the students learn how to handle them. But then on day one of practice, they could be dealing with a horse upside down in a float on the M23. And so I think it's a great shame that we haven't been able to retain that level of training that you were fortunate enough to receive. It's interesting times.
Thank you. I would like to ask your opinion about re-education from the horse's point of view. So, for example, a seven-year-old ex-racehorse had 50 starts, you know, knows the game inside out, been very successful. New owner thinks he'd like to have an eventing horse and wants to re-educate that horse. Just like to hear your opinion about that process.
It's a great question because those ex-racehorses are, let's face it, among the cheaper horses on the market. And it's beguiling to think that for $500 you can get a riding horse for your daughter. But they are, unfortunately, trained in a different way to riding horses. A lot of the racehorses are trained to go forward when you take the pressure off the reins. We want horses to slow down when we apply tension through the reins. So we have to re-educate all of that. It's certainly not impossible, but a lot of the horses that we see in this situation have also been whipped for trying hard and whipped when they are trying hard. So they're often in a slightly frenzied state. If we can peel them off the ceiling, we can re-educate them. But the value of safety and calmness is something that horses are teaching us all the time. The ex-racehorse brings a whole series of challenges, but they're not insurmountable. As it happens, thoroughbreds are becoming perhaps less popular as event horses because the times are less critical, and so warm bloods are rising in eventing because their fast times are not so critical in cross country. But yes, they certainly can be re-educated. The main thing is getting that deceleration cue back, because that's the last thing that people really want in a racehorse is deceleration.
Terrific. Any other questions? Oh, just over here.
Hi. Sorry, I've got the flu, so I'm not doing too well.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
I have Baroque horses. I have Frisians, and they have a different style of brain as far as I'm concerned, and sometimes they can have a lot more attitude, or maybe I'm just biased. Actually, I'm a lot biased. When training them, sometimes you cannot push to get a positive reinforcement. So how do you go about getting that positive? I mean, you say scratches and that works well, but if you're trying to get a trot, you don't want exactly the horse to stop and say, yeah, I love you.
Yeah.
And they do. So how do you look at that?
Well, you can use positive reinforcement in to train a trot. You only give the horse the whistle and then followed by the reward or a click and reward when you've seen the best trot for the day. So part of training, I think, is learning to reserve the rewards until you see an improvement. We call that shaping. And it's a battle of will sometimes, because the animal's saying, well, surely that was good enough. And you have to say, well, and actually, we'd like a bit more. So you can, I've got Frisian crosses, and they've got this, as you know, these huge canters. I know that I can, my horses will canter on just a verbal cue, and I know that I've reinforced that positively, because if they're in certain parts of the arena, they just start cantering on the lunge, because that's where they last got a reward. So you can use positive reinforcement, but I think they are sensitive souls, and a lot of the Baroque breeds are. That actually demands more horsemanship on our behalf, on our side. They're an interesting challenge, and I'm sure you're up to it, especially if you've had one or two. But each breed comes with its own instruction manual. We just need to know how to read it.
Terrific. I think we've got time for one more question. We've got one here at the front. Thanks, Susan.
There isn't really an instruction manual for Frisians. Yeah. We have to be students of horse behaviour to read them. That's what I'm saying, yeah.
I'm a dog trainer, and I'm interested in with horses as well as dogs about, is there any research into emotional arousal levels?
Yes.
And in what state they make the change? So in that moment where you might be getting a trot and you want a little bit more, you generally get a heightened level of arousal before that occurs. Is there something that we can use so that our timing can become a little bit more effective as riders and trainers?
Well, there's a really excellent student of mine who's just qualified with a doctorate, and she and I developed this idea that there is an optimal level of arousal and an optimal level of affective state or mood in the animal for each type of training. So positive reinforcement requires a certain style of arousal and affective state. Negative reinforcement might work with a completely different landscape. So what we've done is we put this paper online. So if you go online and do a search for Starling and McGreevy, you'll be able to download the paper, and we've got horse examples in there of these landscapes, and you can actually move them around on the screen to see where you think the optimal level of arousal or affective state is for the tool you've reached for from your toolkit. And the animals are telling us where they're working best in those different quadrants of that operant conditioning framework. So I'd encourage you to read the paper, and by all means email me if once you've read it, you have some questions. It's conceptualising the two things that you've identified: the optimal arousal for the behaviour you want, but also the techniques that you're using. Yeah.
And do you find generally that riders or trainers tend to not give soon enough because of that?
I think, unfortunately, contact has increased. The latest evidence is that more horses are competing behind the vertical than they were 12 years ago. A lot more horses are competing behind the vertical at the highest levels. And the marks have gone up. So there's something wrong with the judging system. If I'm ever found dead outside the vet faculty, it will be because a dressage judge has taken me out. But I think it's really important that we get dressage right, and then all the other sports could benefit. But the technology is now exposing some serious problems with the way we are being shown to ride by the elite riders. And so we need to look to technology to get us back on track. We're working with a Swedish group that hope to have reins that change colour when they're pulled too tight, so that a coach on the ground could actually say that's way off the scale, and nose bands that change colour when they're too tight. So I think there are fashions in the way animals are trained, and we need to make sure that science at every stage does what it can to keep people honest, to remove the bullshit, and give the animals the best chance of having a happy working environment.
Terrific, thank you. Can I thank everyone for their participation today, and I invite you to thank Paul for all that he's contributed to us. Thanks, everybody. Just before we head off, I just wanted to let you know that some of the books that Paul referred to in his talk are available for sale today. If you want to have a look, they're over there on the table. So feel free to go and have a look at that. You probably are conscious, if you've seen Spirited, the exhibition, that Paul is featured in a couple of videos in the exhibition, which we were really thrilled to be able to work with Paul to make those. And they're available online. There's a half-hour-long video that illustrates some of the principles behind foundation training, which many visitors have said they found really interesting. If you're interested, if you visit the museum's website and then navigate your way through to the Spirited exhibition, you'll be able to find that, to view those online. We'd really like to encourage you to visit Unbridled tomorrow. Hopefully some of you are going. A terrific event, first time here in Canberra, a horse festival that everyone will find something to enjoy and interest them at. It's on tomorrow at Thoroughbred Park. I think there's a flyer on your seats. So if you want any more information about that, you can have a chat to some of us here. We really hope that the event goes spectacularly well tomorrow. Paul will be speaking, so if you'd like another chance to hear Paul talk, you have an opportunity tomorrow. I just want to let you know, this is the final lecture in the Spirited series of talks, but there's still lots more to come, lots more events associated with the exhibition, including the Spirited Horse Show, which is coming up in January with Tim O'Brien, who's a fourth generation cattleman from Tumarumba. So there'll be a great family-orientated show around horsemanship with the museum's Spirited Horse Show coming up in January, as well as our Australia Day Festival, which will be horse-themed this year, if you're interested in coming along. So it's just the time now just to wrap again. Thank you all for coming. Thank you to the events and public programs team for putting this together, and thank Paul again. Thank you so much.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.